Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And Jim, let's start with the good. The good news is that, at least for right now, it doesn't look like Nancy Pelosi is probably going anywhere. At least she's not going anywhere without a fight. After John Ossoff lost, despite the Democrats pumping tens of millions of dollars into his special election in Georgia, it came up empty on Tuesday night. Karen Handel won. And so some of the knives in the Democratic Party came out for Nancy Pelosi, since John Ossoff was tied to Nancy Pelosi in a lot of the advertising towards the end of that campaign. You've got Tim Ryan, who challenged Pelosi for Democratic leader, saying the brand is toxic. You've got even some Democratic women in the House saying it's time for a leadership change. Nancy Pelosi, though, is pretty good at rallying the troops. I don't know whether she knows about every skeleton in every closet on Capitol Hill, but there's a lot of loyalty to her, whether it's genuine or compelled. Nonetheless, she says that she is the right person to continue leading the House Democrats. And when asked why at her Thursday briefing, she offered this humble summation.
So you want me to sing my praises? Is that what you're saying? Why should I? Well, I'm a master legislator. I am a strategic, politically astute leader. I am leadership is recognized by many around the country, and that is why I'm able to attract the support that I do, which is essential to our election, sad to say. I'm very pleased at the cooperation that we're doing, working with all the social media and small donor community to change how we communicate, but also how we attract resources, intellectual and financial, to the party. I have experience in winning the Congress.
You have a little bit of experience in winning a Congress. You have a ton of experience in losing a Congress. And so, Jim, Nancy Pelosi is determined to not be run out by her own party, and most conservatives are on her side in this one. We don't team up with her often, but we'd love to see her stay.
Oh, Greg, you know, you see a lot of Democrats, or you're hearing the rumbling from the backbenchers. They're fed up with it. She's making very clear that she will not go without a fight. Pass the popcorn. Let's go. Let's get it on. The really kind of intriguing, I could actually make something of a qualified defense of Pelosi and say, look, the Democratic Party's problems do not begin and end with her. You could argue that it is more structural, that they have become the party of cities and really have lost touch with the suburbs, the exurbs, and rural America. You could make the argument they become way too wrapped up in cultural identity politics and don't speak to the economic concerns of the average American. You could argue that they are increasingly dominated by an angry left that is dominating college campuses, some corners of the media, some corners of Hollywood, and all of that alienates them from the voters they really need to win back to get a majority again. None of that, if you changed Nancy Pelosi as leader of the Democratic Party, that would not, those problems really wouldn't go away overnight. Having said all that, she sure as heck makes it a lot easier. In part because, look, she literally lives on Billionaires Row in San Francisco. San Francisco has some really wonderful attractions. People like visiting it, but a lot of people don't want to live there. And whether she likes to acknowledge it or not, everything from the Folsom Street Parade to serious homeless problems, the perception of it being a city of either super wealthy or super poor, increasingly hostile to anybody with traditional values, just increasingly an isolated enclave that the super wealthy out there don't realize what life is like for people just across the bay in places like Oakland or in the Central Valley or in the rest of California. There's a reason people feel that way about her. And if you had the Democrats led by somebody like Tim Ryan, you know, would Republicans still be able to attempt to paint Democrats as out of touch and elitist and all that stuff? Sure, but it's not as easy to do that for a guy who represents Akron and Youngstown. I think it's safe to say, you know, geographically, culturally, and by a lot of other measures, people who represent districts like that are going to be in a more in touch with the rest, not just the rest of the country, but I think even the rest of the party, than somebody who lives in a district like Nancy Pelosi's, where Republicans are effectively theoretical. I'm sure there are some Republicans somewhere in this, you know, in the northern tip of San Francisco. But by and large, it is probably the most, one of the most liberal districts in the country, if not the most liberal district. And you're probably going to have problems with that. Nancy Pelosi, on a regular basis, is going to do things that are extremely left, that are extremely far on the left, and just aren't going to play well in places like Ohio and Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and all these other places the Democrats want to come back to. So the good news for Republicans is there's really no sign of this getting better. And you know what? I mean, look, you and I are not Democrats. But maybe the Democrats need to have this fight. Maybe they really need to hash out who, what they stand for, who they really want to represent. Whether a sense of cultural superiority is more important to them than winning races, because I think you can kind of argue so far it is, as my boss and colleague Rich Lowry put it. Look, Democrats are willing to do absolutely anything to defeat Donald Trump except rethink their orthodoxy on abortion, guns, and all these other cultural issues.
What a difference a week makes. A few days ago, this race in Georgia was supposed to be the bellwether that shows that America is completely turned on Donald Trump and Democrats were gearing up for this massive rout in 2018. Now the knives are out for Nancy Pelosi. They're admitting they have no message. Their brand is toxic, and there's practically a non-shooting civil war going on in the Democratic Party right now. So it's amazing what blowing $30 million will do for your party, huh?
Bloosh.
All right. Let's move on to the bad martini now. And, Jim, yesterday the Senate Republicans unveiled their version of health care reform. It's called the Better Care Reconciliation Act of 2017. Very catchy. It's not an acronym, so maybe that's one of the reasons why a lot of people don't like it. But it does what pretty much we expected it to do, given some of the reports that were leaking out. It's more generous with how it winds down the Medicaid expansion. There's more subsidies in there than the House bill. They leave a lot of the Obamacare structure for tax credits in there. They do make some changes on that front. There's some concern from conservatives. There's four Republicans who say right now they can't vote for it, which would be enough to kill it. Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, Mike Lee, Ron Johnson, they say it doesn't go far enough towards what we need to get done in terms of repealing Obamacare and actually reducing the cost of premiums. So right now, there's a little bit of disappointment. On the other hand, you've got folks like Ovick Roy, who thinks this could potentially be the greatest public policy achievement by a Republican Congress in his lifetime. The Democrats, of course, announced their opposition before they read a word of it. They had their doctors in white coats. They had their protesters in the hall and Chuck Schumer promising delaying tactics. So what do you make of it?
I would say Ovick Roy is probably the right of center healthcare wonk who I trust the most and whose assessment I was most interested in hearing, and he is basically doing cartwheels over this. He said it. He is singing its praises and is really impressed by it. The flips, you would not expect he and Rand Paul or he and Mike Lee to have completely different assessments. So this is a little bit weird. I must say I do see why certain conservatives, particularly fiscal conservatives, look at this and say, eh. – as I wrote in the Morning Jolt today, there are a lot of folks who say, this is effectively eliminating Medicaid now, or so virtually eliminating was the phrase I saw used over at Esquire. Now, the really tough, this is basically, it puts a cap on how much a state can spend for each Medicaid recipient. We can argue about whether that's a good idea. It certainly is effective for cost control. On the other hand, it's not hard to imagine a scenario where somebody's got a really serious health problem and what the treatment they need is going to cost more than what that cap is. And depending on how much higher it goes beyond that cap, if you're on Medicaid, you're generally on the poorer, you're very much on the poorer end of a spectrum, even if you're in one of those states that expanded the eligibility, there's a good chance you're going to need some treatment and it's going to cost you a lot of money that you may or may not have. Having said that, all of the really, but that doesn't count as eliminating Medicaid, and I think, or even a quote unquote virtual elimination of Medicaid. And oh, by the way, the really tough cuts to Medicaid, the really more stringent elimination, which is again basically changing the way they calculate inflation, how much do they increase that cap per person, kicks in 2025, Greg. Now let's kind of look down, let's look at the calendar. All right, let's assume Trump has a good first term. It's up for re-election in 2020. Let's say he gets reelected. he gets reelected and he serves a full term again, and he gets out of office in 2024 will be the next election. January 2025, the next president would take office, and that's when the really tough cuts would kick in. Greg, have we seen this before? Where, you know, we're going to give you the good stuff now, and these really tough cuts you don't like 8 years from now. That's when we're going. We totally promise, CBO. We totally promise 8 years. Actually, you know, more than 8 years from now, we swear we're really going to tighten our belts. We're really going to, you know, buckle down and save money. We're really going to get control of our spending. The 8 years and tomorrow from now. If you're a fiscal conservative, you probably feel like you've heard this before. And see this as a bit of you know, cynical budgeting mechanism there. And, you know, the other thing also, which I'm a little, I don't say intrigued by or troubled by, it includes a retroactive cut on capital gains and investment income of 3.8%. Now, generally, I like this. I do think putting this in the healthcare bill does make it much easier for Democrats to say, this is a tax cut for the rich. But because it only applies to, you know, this is a one that was imposed in Obamacare. That was designed to generate money to pay for all the things that Obamacare wanted to do. You basically are effectively cutting taxes on the rich. So this is a one time where the Democratic criticism is kind of fairly accurate. It's one of those things where I almost would want to get the tax stuff out of this bill, just because it just provides such an easy avenue of Democratic attack. And clearly this tax increase did not cripple the economy. The way that besides the fact that I want a broad-based tax reform bill, I don't necessarily want to just only cut taxes on investment income for people making more than $250,000. In other words, if I have a limited amount of political capital for tax cuts, this isn't really where I want to focus it. Other conservatives may have different interpretations on that. But anyway, you have something which we all knew no Democrat was going to vote for this. We all knew this was pretty much going to be a partisan straight down the line bill. And now the intriguing thing is to see the Ron Johnson of the world having a problem. Pat Toomey said he's not on board with this. There are a lot of concerns. This is not just Rand Paul being off on himself, being perfectly comfortable to vote for a, you know, 98-2 style vote. I think there are a lot of Republicans who are looking this way. The Susan Collins of the world aren't going to like this because the perception it's too mean. And I think the real fiscal conservatives are going to look at this and say, look, we're pushing all the hard decisions 8 years down the road, and this is not what we promised we were going to do. I don't know that they're going to get this thing passed by 4th of July, which is allegedly the plan here. So I foresee a bumpy road for this. Look, maybe McConnell pulls everybody together. Maybe they tweak it. It sounds like there are a couple of senators who want to see more for opioid addiction and stuff like that. Maybe that'll bring them on board. But I have to say right now, this is not – I would say the outlook for this bill is challenged, which is not to say that, you know, passage is impossible.
Well, that's a lot more words than repeal and replace, which it's one of the reasons we've talked about Republicans having a little bit more of a complicated effort here than they've promised over the past four election cycles. But getting as close as you can to that promise is going to make your base a lot happier than it probably is right now. But Jim, let's move on to the crazy martini now. And Donald Trump, of course, has set the news media on its head a couple times with his tweets when you talk about being tapped at Trump Tower from the Obama administration and so forth. And of course, shortly after he fired Jim Comey as FBI director, he mentioned that Comey better hope there aren't any tapes. And he always puts it in quotes for some reason. There are no tapes of their conversations in the Oval Office that he suggested would back up his version of their conversations as regards to Mike Flynn and so forth. And so there's been a lot of speculation. Are there actually tapes? And you've had these intelligence committees saying, well, if there are tapes, you got to turn them over. And I think today was the deadline for doing that, which is why Trump tweeted yesterday, with all of the recently reported electronic surveillance, intercepts, unmasking, and illegal leaking of information, I have no idea whether there are tapes, in quotes, of course, or recordings of my conversations with James Comey. But I did not make and do not have any such recordings. So on one sense here, obviously, Trump has been playing a little bit of a game here, especially with that press conference where he suggested that folks would find out soon and they might be disappointed. On the other hand, Jim, if you actually read literally his tweet from when he first talked about Comey better hope there aren't tapes, maybe he's actually pretty consistent here. I don't know. What do you think?
Let me this way. Greg, if you and I had a dispute and you know, you and I had a different, you know, we disagreed and I'd said to you, hey, Greg, you better hope there aren't tapes, and there aren't. It's not really, it's a really weird bit of bluster. You'd better hope that there is something doesn't exist. And Oh, by the way, it doesn't. Because I suppose this could be seen as sort of, you know, making Comey nervous. Maybe there are tapes. I'd better not lie. But you know, Comey's got his memos of how things occurred and how the conversations went down. I suppose if you think of Comey as a pathological liar, then this was a intriguing nine-level chess defense mechanism against Comey giving an inaccurate event. But now we just know that Trump, certainly I think it is fair and reasonable to interpret Trump's tweet as suggesting the possibility that there are tapes. Otherwise, you wouldn't bring it up. We always kind of figured the Secret Service would have some sort of monitoring system in the Oval Office or in the White House for, you know, God forbid somebody comes and tries to break in or something. So you kind of wonder, there might be tapes. But anyway, so as far as, you know, everyone involved says, as far as they know, there are no tapes. So you're saying you'd better hope something doesn't exist, but deep down Trump already knows it doesn't exist. So Greg, doesn't this kind of, you know, hey, you better hope there's no Loch Ness Monster. And, oh, by the way, there is no Loch Ness Monster. You know, like, it's one of those things where Trump guessing that there were tapes? Was Trump hoping that there were tapes? This is such a weird bit of you know, it's like attempting to rattle a saber without actually having the saber. It's, you know, this, I have this card to play against you, but he's bluffing because he doesn't actually have the card to play. And you know, at some point this is going to have to come out, that you're going to have to answer the question. Right after Trump does that tweet, Sean Spicer, in, you know, a long, uncomfortable term as White House press secretary, has one of his longest and most uncomfortable moments where he says he's spoken to the president and he says the tweet speaks for itself. But it doesn't. It doesn't speak for itself. It does not answer the question of whether the tapes existed or not. And Spicer got questioned this several times. And then Trump got asked the question. And he said, yes, we're going to answer that question in the future, and it's going to disappoint you, which kind of seemed to hint that it wasn't there. But again, why would you then raise the possibility of there being tapes? It doesn't, you know, because I don't think it really did this. And in fact, this, you know, according to Comey's own testimony, this is one of the things that spurred him to leak his memos to the New York Times. So this is something completely backfired on Trump. Trump needs, you know, on live television, they have a 7-second delay. Trump needs a 70-minute delay on his tweets, where somebody in the White House counsel's office can look at this and say, you know what? You really don't want to tweet this, Mr. President. This is going to cause you headaches down the road. Let's leave that. Let's tweet out something else different or something like that. Apparently, even Kellyanne Conway has said periodically during the campaign, she's like, can we tweet something happy today? Is there something nice going on that's, you know, we can salute or recognize or call attention to or stuff? So every president has these moments. We heard from the Nixon tapes, the degree to which, you know, every president fumes. Bill Clinton used to go into his purple rages. You know, presidents get angry and they get irritated and they get frustrated and they start, you know, blowing off steam. The problem is this president does it in a format where everybody can see it, and it causes a lot of complications down the road. So I don't know, Greg, maybe the president needs a vacation.
You're going on vacation.
That's right. I'm the one who needs it, so I won't have to deal with this anymore. At least for a week.
Have a great vacation next week, and David French will be in for most of the week next week. Jim, you and I will reconvene on July 5th, so have a great time.
See you that day, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks so much for being with us. Have a great weekend, everyone, and tune in Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.